Not that I'm an expert, by the way, not at all. But you know, what productive thing could I do? Well, I've decided that I'm going to answer this question: how do we go the distance? By actually just doing an extended book review. I'm going to do an extended book review of Bob Burns, Tasha Chapman, and Donald Guthrie, called Resilient Ministry: What Pastors Told Us About Surviving and Thriving. And hang on, let's just put that up there. And you can get a copy of that at the Wandering Bookseller. So I'm going to go through this book. Now, can I just ask, just to get some sort of discussion going, I'm totally new to Zoom. Maybe take yourselves off mute if you can. And has anyone heard of this book or read this book?
I have not.
Yeah, I have.
It's been recommended to me, and I'm looking forward to hearing about your review.
Nice. Cool. Hey, thanks everyone. That was really good. Like I say, this is all very new to me.
Discussion, guys.
All right. So the goal of this seminar, I'll put up for you as well. There's the goals of today's seminar. Or is this a webinar? Am I doing a webinar right now? Stupid word in the world, and somehow I find myself doing one. All right. Number one, to begin...
Are we webinese by attending a webinar? Absolutely. Does that make us webinese?
Ah, and that's even more silly. So... the goals of this webinar is to begin getting us thinking. Begin. Some of you have already thought a lot about this, I know. So forgive me for saying the word begin. To continue for you, to get us thinking about some of the areas that you should be personally pursuing to help yourself go the distance in ministry. So either begin or continue to get us thinking. And then secondly, to whet your appetite for you to get a copy of this book and read it. And then note, I've never run a webinar and would love your interaction. How am I doing so far? Thumbs up. Yeah, thumbs up. Okay. So this book, Resilient Ministry, What Pastors Told Us About Surviving and Thriving, they did an enormous study in the USA. They looked at male, married ministers. These the wives of these ministers were included in all the discussions and all the research. These ministers had an evangelical commitment because they were all graduates or connected with evangelical seminaries. They chose ministers who were novice, seasoned, and veteran. So across from greenhorn through to journeyman through to old dog, you know, and they got age range and experience of pastors. They chose pastors who were either senior ministers of a team, a solo pastor in a church, or a church planter. They chose pastors from rural, suburban, and urban settings, small and large church, African American, Anglo, Hispanic, Asian. And they got them to meet in small groups to discuss lots and lots of questions. And they called them cohorts, and then they got them to meet together in large groups, which they called summits. And they did this research over 7 years. So for 7 years, they studied what helps pastors survive and thrive. What sorts of things do you think were on the list? Hit me up. What do you think was there?
Mentor.
Having a mentor.
Exercise.
Doing exercise.
Eating well,
yeah.
Intimacy.
Intimacy. Did someone say intimacy? Yes.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay, cool. Thank you, Alan. Yep. Oh, definitely.
Quiet times.
Yeah, so daily reading the Bible and prayer, or daily or however frequent it is. Yep. Cool. Okay. Well, they present five overall principles that, humanly speaking, contribute to a resilient ministry. And what they do is they devote two chapters to each of these principles. And I'm just going to walk you through these five overall principles now. I think you're going to be surprised. The first one, perhaps not so surprising, this is what they call the concept of spiritual formation. So this is the ongoing process of maturing as a Christian. Regularly in their book, in their chapters, they call it abiding in Christ. Quote, this is a quote, long-term fruitfulness comes from the overflow of our walk with Christ. Or another quote, ministry staff are often so caught up in doing church work that they fail to do the work of the church, which begins when we abide in Christ. So they go through all of these different passages of the Bible which look at the importance of every believer resting, believing, trusting in Jesus Christ, working out their salvation with fear and trembling. So they go through this idea of the need to be growing as a Christian in the first chapter. And then in their second chapter on spiritual formation, they really try and apply it. Ways in which we, humanly speaking, and from our side of things, ways in which we grow in our relationship with Jesus. And I'm going to give you a couple of the things that they raise, a couple of the things that they talk about. First of all, they talk about building patterns. They say when you're trying to grow in your relationship with Jesus, what they found is that, yes, different people need different patterns at different times in their life in order to pursue spiritual growth. But they also found that there needed to be a deliberate and a settled state in actively pursuing your relationship with Jesus, or it didn't happen. For pastors, even for pastors, especially for pastors, if it's not a deliberate thing, it won't happen. So they talked about building patterns. They talk about accountability. An important part of spiritual formation and growth are having people that you can share with. And I think Alan said intimacy. People you can share with, vent, debrief, confess to. For some of my friends, I've got two mates. One's in ministry and he has a confidant who he shares in, and they actually call it FIFA and chat, where they get together on the PlayStation and they play FIFA all night. And while they do it, they chat about how they're going, how their marriage is going, and all that kind of stuff, right? FIFA and chat. That's the kind of thing. Now, interestingly, in this section of the book, the authors differentiate between an ally and a confidant. And this is quite an important distinction for them that comes up a number of times throughout the book. They say an ally is someone who is on your side and they are a blessing, but beware of an ally. Because an ally actually has a higher loyalty than their relationship with you. So, for instance, if I divulge everything to an elder at Crossroads, they're an ally. They support me. I've got such a good relationship with all the elders, thanks to God. But the elder may probably does have a higher loyalty, which is actually to the congregation and to the eldership. And so if I actually divulge all, I could see myself in trouble. Whereas a confidant, and this is what Christine called a mentor, something like that, they really recommend it's somebody who's outside of your sphere, who's a long, long way from where you are now, and someone who you can talk to quite openly. And I know, Carl, you've often referred to the relationship that you had with Peter Adam. And how he was like a bit of a mentor to you, you know, a guy who's outside your denomination, outside your state, someone who's in a similar sort of situation to you. So that was another important element of growing our relationship, our spiritual formation, is accountability. Then another one, and this is really interesting to me, learning through hardships. The writers of this book found from their 7-year study that learning through difficult things that you face is one of the most important things that we can be doing to be growing as Christians. Learning to trust in God, learning to trust in Christ. And they talk about reflecting within an event. So actually sitting down to learn as an event is unfolding, reflecting within an event. And they also talk about reflecting after an event and sitting down after the dust has settled to say, well, what could I learn about that? How have I grown in my dependence upon Jesus Christ and my desire for God's glory? They also talked about the difference between suffering within a supportive team and a supportive environment versus suffering when you have no support or even animosity. And they actually have some really good wisdom there for which kind of situation you find yourself in, you know, and perhaps that's something you can ask about in a sec. So this first principle is called spiritual formation. We're looking at some of the ways they suggest that you can grow, you know, spiritually, building patterns, accountability, learning through hardships. And then I think this is my final one. Yeah, this is my final one that I want to bring out, spiritual disciplines. It was kind of here that they got to the obvious one. I thought this is sort of where they would have started, but this is where they got to the obvious ones. And they do spend a bit of time on this. Spiritual disciplines such as the regular Bible reading, prayer and reflection. That was a huge component of it. Another spiritual discipline that they advocate, and this will be controversial for many of you guys, is they actually advocate a Sabbath that you have weekly as well as a day off, not instead of a day off. So they advocate that you have a day off once a week to, you know, rest with your family, to do stuff, to sport, activity, but then you have a Sabbath as well where you deliberately seek to grow in your personal relationship with God. That's some of the spiritual disciplines that they're advocating. Biblical reflection, prayer, Sabbath. They have a high place for what they call worship, by which they mean the church service. They discuss the idea of whether it's good for people who are heavily involved in a church, and this may not so much apply to you ATS guys, but people who are heavily involved in a church, they say it's worthwhile considering whether you have another church that you might go to occasionally, where you can just actually be a human being who goes to meet with God's people around his word to worship God in a corporate way. So that was an interesting idea there. Now, just before I get your response to some of these things, I thought I'd go through how I've responded to reading this chapter and spending these chapters and spending time on it. There's a couple of ways in which I've responded, and you might find them interesting. So the first thing is that when I was in the USA on long service leave last year, we were in Kentucky, and I committed myself to, I suppose, what you might call spiritual attentiveness. I really wanted to commit myself to growing in my relationship with Jesus. And I spent a lot of time praying about that. I spent a lot of time jotting down what that would actually look like. And thanks to God, I've been able to keep that going since we came back. Look, I know it sounds weird because, well, like a guy who works for a church, surely he would have a, he would be committed to growing as a Christian. Not if you read this book. This book has quotes and snippets and excerpts from their research, from real life church leaders, out of the horse's mouth. And what they were finding is that there's a huge number of church leaders and ministry leaders who aren't dedicated to having a desire for growing spiritually, growing in their relationship with Jesus. So that was the first thing in my own response. The second thing in my own response was, I did it. I started doing a Sabbath as well as having my day off. And so my Sabbath is on Thursdays, which is today. I'm not doing it today because I'm here with y'all. But I do that on Thursdays. Often it only ends up being for the morning. But then in the afternoon, you know, I have to go and do meetings and other stuff. And then on Saturdays, I have my day off. So that's one way I've responded. And I'll be happy to answer questions about that. Then on Sundays, when I go to church, when I'm at church, I deliberately see myself as a Christian who's coming to worship God in a communal type way, to gather with his people around the word. And I have to actually consciously think of that. And I have to consciously ignore the fact that that things are happening all around me that require my attention. It was crazy the other week at church. This kid, I don't know what was going on, but he took almost all his clothes off and ran across the stage in the middle of the church service. And every part of me wanted to kind of do something and deal with it. And I just went, no, like I am trying to really concentrate on this. I'm trying to work against everything within me that just wants to fix everything. And then the other thing that I've done to respond to this for my own spiritual formation is I do have a secret church I go to. I'm not going to tell you what it is. I only go twice a year, but I've made a bit of a commitment and I've spoken to the minister of that church and he knows why I come and he lets me be. And I usually go on Christmas Eve and maybe like sometime over Easter or something like that. But one thing that we are trying to do at Crossroads is that I will have a roster day off church. So once every 2 months, I will attend church, but I'll not be on anything. I'll not be praying. I will not be leading anything. I'll not be preaching. And I just go along with my baggy jeans and my crusty jumper and my black Crocs, and I can just sit with my family. And that's been okay. That's sort of worked, but often there's a pull to go and do things. So I'm sure you'll have lots of comments that you might want to make, and I can see there's a few questions coming up there. I have some questions for you as well. I'm not quite sure how to do this. Perhaps you ask me your questions, and I will put my questions up, and you can think about your questions. Have you got any questions about it, about how I've done it?
Dan, do you want to tell us a bit about the content of your Sabbath mornings? What are you using that time for?
Yeah, so what I do is I take the kids to school in the morning. So that's the morning Miranda doesn't have to do the school run, which she loves. And then I come back and we're listening to Wayne Grudem's theology lectures, which we just listen to on podcast, and we love those. And Miranda in particular has been really, really helped with some of the issues that she's been facing by actually weirdly thinking through, again, some of the things that Mikey was talking through in the first session we had today, like about things like sinfulness, depravity, you know, who she is as a creature of God. All of those things have been a massive blessing to her. So we do a lecture together, and we usually just pray together, and then I'll go and read the Bible and pray myself and journal down how I've found the week. I'm also using the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which was actually designed for Christians to use on the Sabbath. So I'm slowly learning that. And then I'll do a bit of like research and stuff. And one of my things that I'm thinking about at the moment is Christianity and the environment. And so I'll just do some reading on that topic. And that's usually all I've got time for. But I try and take it slow. I don't go heaps hard. I have lots of coffee along the way and it's nice. So you can see that I put some questions up there in the chat box. We don't have to do them now, but you should consider these questions. What patterns have helped you in your relationship with Christ? What habits aren't helpful? What, if any, should you try and develop? Consider whether and how you might seek to grow your relationship with Jesus and God the Father through a Sabbath as well as a day off, and consider creative ways that you might do that. And then I want to ask a bit of a COVID-19 question. What good things that you do have just gone out the window in the last few weeks, and what do you need to do to respond to that? You know, we don't want to lose our good things. So there's some questions there that I'd like you to consider. Just before I move on to the next one, just a final comment before we move on to the next principle. So this is still under the idea of spiritual formation. This isn't the ultimate reason you do spiritual formation, but what a blessing for your people. Right? I'm thinking of passages now in Proverbs and Psalms. I'm thinking of the Apostle Paul, his life. Of course, I'm thinking of Jesus. It is such a blessing for your church or for your fellowship groups, for your parachurch ministry, such a blessing to see someone living God's way. When they see you living God's way, it's one of the great blessings that you can give to your people, especially at this time. And so the investment, like I say, it's not the ultimate reason you do it, but the investment of this time is a true blessing for your church or for those in AFES, for the people of your ministry. So that was just a final comment for us at this time. Any more questions before we move on? I'm conscious of my time. All right.
Yeah, Dan, just quickly.
Yeah.
So just give it a two-word answer. That the whole Sabbath distinction from day off,
yes.
Was that for them a theological category or a practical one?
Well, you can say
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know exactly for them.
Yeah, that's totally fine. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, for them, I don't know exactly. Like, theologically, there's a few differences in this as I read this book. Yeah.
Yeah, like for you, I can see the way that you've done it, like that there's an obedience and godliness to it, which I really appreciate. So there's like theological reason for you. I just wondered if their recommendation was merely born from the research or if it was actually they did some.
Ah, yes, okay. Yeah. Much more of a pragmatic issue for them. Yeah. So we'll move on to the next one. Now this is the obvious principles. This is the second of five principles. Sorry, I'm just trying to look at this. And this is the obvious one, self-care. Hang on, is that not working? Self-care. I just put that up at the bottom and it hasn't come through in large text.
Dan, are you going to make some sort of basic notes available for this afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, I can give you my notes on the proviso that you just ignore all the crazy typos that are all through there. I mean, if you think Mikey's bad, you should see me. So, secondly, self-care. And here what, and this is the one that you would expect because you guys were saying, oh, go for a run, eat good food, get plenty of sleep. This was the one that we normally think of when we think of how to go the distance. First and foremost, we are human people. We are human Christian people, created people. And I saw a few questions coming up about that, our created being. And so we needed to steward our lives well to the glory of God. This means the book says we need to address our physical, emotional, mental and spiritual needs. They make a big distinction in their chapter between our role at church and who we are as a person. And obviously they discuss the blend, the overlap, but they want to have a distinction between our identity and our role, that I am not just my role. And they address this by looking at numerous Bible passages, and they discuss issues like ministry stardom, ministry celebrity. They also discuss ministry depression, overwork, and overfunctioning, trying to prove yourself. So these are some of the ways that they sort of discuss this issue of identity and role. And once they've spelt out this distinction between identity and role, they actually give three ways to solve or address that issue. So how do we, you know, deal with the fact that as ministry leaders, we are so often overlapping with our role, that who we are overlaps with what we do? Well, they have three ways to approach this problem. Number one, I have my own personal relationship with Jesus aside from my role. So that's one of the things that they talk about. Put that note there. Two, this one surprised me. I have genuine friendships outside my role. That was a big thing for them. And then three, I have genuine interests and real projects outside my role. So I think I'm about to put these up. Just so I can. Not sure what's going on there.
Computer says no.
Computer says no. There you go. So these are the things that they want us to do. You can see my own personal relationship with Jesus outside my role. You can see that brings back to that spiritual formation thing. Genuine friendships, the reason they talk about friendships is so important is a genuine friendship with someone outside your role is to counter isolation and to be affirming who you are as a person. And then interests and projects for you to have a different area of life where you can express yourself. And they go through, so that's their first chapter on the topic of self-care. I hope this is not too confusing. And then in their second chapter, they actually go through four different selves. They talk about emotional self-care, social self-care, intellectual self-care, and physical self-care, which is the one that some of you picked up on. Emotional self-care. They say, I know my own feelings and I can describe what I'm feeling. And actually at the back of the book, they have a huge list of just an enormous list of emotions. And they actually get you, they say, start practicing just naming the emotion that you're feeling. Many of us can't do that. And so they get you trying to put a label on how you're feeling. Emotional self-care. They talk about social self-care, which again is the importance of friendship. They talk about intellectual self-care. So sharp, fresh, proactive, provocative learning. What my mate Wilbur Longbottom from City Bible Forum, what he calls learning, not burning. There's things coming in, not just so they can go out, but there's things coming in to refresh and sharpen and provoke. And here with intellectual self-care, they give another plug for doing a weekly Sabbath. And then physical self-care, I know my body, I treat it well, I know its limits, I'm settled into good rhythms and good health. And that's some of the things that you mentioned there. Now, just before I hear from you, I just thought I would give some reflections from me on this and some ways in which I've responded to this chapter. I hope that will be helpful. One of the ways I've responded to this chapter is by the recognition that other people have difficult jobs at Crossroads. Others have difficult jobs. Amongst your university students, some have demanding coursework, their hours, their inflexible schedules, their boss, their difficult co-workers. Many of us have difficult work, and being a pastor is one of them. Being a ministry leader on a uni campus is one of them. It was interesting yesterday, the head of Presbyterian Social Services, her name's Liz McLean, she did a blog post and sent it out to all the Presbyterian churches, and the heading was "A Plea for Compassion on Our Leaders." And she was just basically saying this. She was saying, look, it's hard. It's hard right now. We're all trying to make things up as best we can. We're all behind the eight ball. Let's be compassionate. So I just wanted to put that in there. I want you to give yourselves a break. I want me to give myself a break as we go through all these difficult times, just recognising it's hard. Another application point from me was that I actually think we do have a healthy culture of what the authors call self-care here in Tasmania. As I look at other leaders I know, I actually mostly know their interests. So I actually know Carl does trombone. He's in a choir. I also, well, I did find out today that he also does crochet. So there you have it. Like, I didn't know that, man. Of course, we know about Mikey and his rollerblading and podcasting and all of that kind of stuff. So I actually know a lot of my fellows and their interests. I think we've got a good culture of this. Luke Hansard has weird logs beside his house that grow shiitake mushrooms, and he goes outside his house and fusses over his shiitake mushrooms. You know, I mean, what is with that? That's even weirder than crochet to me. But here are, I think there's a good culture. But then let's follow on from that. There are some who aren't with us today on this Zoom chat who may not have a strong, healthy culture of this. It could be your boss, the person who's actually overseeing the church, who's not here. It could be your fellow worker in AFES who's in Victoria. It could be your fellow apprentice. And so there's actually a possibility to begin having this chat with other people, like how you're going, looking after yourself. And then the final application for me is, again, same point of application. What a blessing for your people to have you physically and emotionally well. That's a blessing for your people. Not on sick leave, not on workers' compensation, having mental health burdens, but feeling fresh, learning there each week, and especially at this time of coronavirus, that they can see you on the church stream each week. That'll really give them a great encouragement. You don't have to do anything much, just be there, be turning up. So I wonder if you've got any questions about that, and I'll also put up a discussion question for you to think about yourself. But do you have any questions about that?
I would just want to affirm the emotional intelligence side of things. Having that list of emotions can be quite eye-opening about there being a whole range of emotions at play. There's a book called Nonviolent Communication that delves into this and helps you think through how your emotions are at play with your physical body and with your mind and your spirit. And they actually have a framework for how to communicate your emotions or understand them yourself. And so you start with the problem that makes you feel something, and you try and make it as objective as possible. So instead of placing negative or positive value on the action that really upset you, for instance, you just say, this is what happened. And then you say, okay, so X happened. It made me feel, and then you kind of go to that list and you pick out a few of how it made you feel. And then it's followed by X made me feel Y because I need, and that's your Z, and it also has a list of needs that we have as humans, physical needs, emotional needs, spiritual needs. And it helps you understand yourself emotionally in that way. But if you can use it as a journaling practice so that you can know yourself well in that extent, it also helps you communicate that to other people in your, so like your next person that you probably use it with is probably your spouse. And, like, sweetheart, when, when the cups are left beside the sink instead of inside the dishwasher, it makes me feel frustrated because I need space and I need to be not cluttered, and it helps my brain and body think and act clearly. Something along those lines. But then it also works in ministry so that you can help your people know that you're a human who has feelings and has needs. And I found it really helpful to start with the journaling and practice within your immediate network of family and friends. And then it helps you communicate it more broadly.
Yeah.
Am I the only person in the room who finds the language of needs one that they find hard to articulate? Like, that doesn't ring true to me. Like, I'm totally with Christine's principles, but for me, I find it like, I don't need it. I'll be fine. She'll be, I guess the stoic thing, she'll be right. I don't need that. I'll be all right. It'd be nice, but I guess I'll cope. Can anyone else relate to that as being a tricky?
Yeah.
And then what did we have? What did we have there? We had, look, if anyone wants to comment on Mikey's comment, go now. Thank you very much, Christine. If you could put that up as well, that might be a blessing for the people who are here listening. I'm going to keep us moving. It's interesting that we're talking about emotional and cultural intelligence, because that's actually the third principle. So the third principle that they have learnt from pastors, how do pastors and ministry leaders survive and thrive? Well, they've gone with, on the third one, they've gone with emotional and cultural intelligence. Really interesting. I found this discussion quite fascinating. They talk about EQ, so not intelligence quotient, but emotion quotient. Stupid thing, but... And they talk about EQ self. I am aware of my own emotions. And Christine was chatting about that. And we're talking about a big long list that they have at the end so I can name. And then they talk about EQ other. I'm actually aware of what others are doing with their emotions at me. Because others are emoting at me. I'm trying to be aware of what others are doing with their emotions toward me. So they talk about EQ self, they talk about EQ other, and then they actually talk about cultural intelligence. I know what culture is. I know how it affects me. I understand something of my church culture. I understand my family culture and my family of origin and how that affects the way I respond to a situation. When I'm in conflict, am I a hedgehog who goes passive-aggressive and puts out my spine, or am I a rhinoceros? When conflict happens, I just charge through the other person with strong words. I actually know these things about myself and my cultural situation. And so they call cultural intelligence the ability to function effectively across different cultural contexts. The ability to function effectively across different cultural contexts. I'm thinking here about... you know, one of the people who goes to Crossroads, and he wouldn't mind me naming him, Peter Chewett. He's been a missionary in Philippines, a missionary in Indonesia. He worked in an entirely African-American church in Alabama. He's worked in churches in Mississippi. He's been a seminary professor, and he's done two lengthy stints in Ulverston, in the Christian Reformed Church. And... even now, a lot of the young people of Crossroads really like his preaching. They really relate. Mikey was telling me the other day how much Mikey's own kids like listening to Peter preach. There's somebody who obviously has a real appreciation of different cultural contexts. He doesn't change his words. He doesn't put his hat on backwards and trying to be cool or something. Like, he's just himself, but... he's able to connect with others. And this is a very important skill that they found that pastors and ministry leaders needed if they were going to survive and thrive. So here's a bit of a discussion question for you. I'd like to hear back from you. What happens when our emotional intelligence is low. What happens when we have a low emotional intelligence?
We react.
React. What is that? What can you just say a little bit more about what that means, Tash?
Well, instead of looking inward and upward to what we in the way we should communicate to that person, we just automatically look outward and project and just react, as opposed to relying on any kind of emotional intelligence or emotion or EQ for the other person.
Yeah, it's excellent. Yeah, react. And I'm glad you said that word, because for me, one of my catchphrases, so Christine talked us through a pattern of how she and others, a four-part process, how she and others will respond in a situation. For me, I have a little catchphrase, which is respond, don't react. So rather than going with what all my emotions are telling me to do, I try and stop, think about, name what those emotions are, recognize what they are, and then actually try and respond to the situation rather than, as you said, Natasha, don't react. So respond, don't react has been one of the helpful things that I've had in difficult meetings where I feel like someone's having a go at me and my blood starts pumping, I'm getting flooded. Respond, don't react has been one of the things that's helped me. I just want to keep going. COVID-19, application point here. You know, we and the people of our ministries are going through a lot. If half of what they are predicting happens, it's going to be an enormous disaster for the world. If I'm not properly realizing I'm anxious, if I'm not realizing I'm overfunctioning, if I'm not realizing my country is in crisis, if I'm not realizing that people are overfunctioning at me, if I'm trying to control the situation, if I'm trying to prove myself a hero leader, like if I'm doing all of these things, oh man, like I could really get myself in a lot of trouble. So like I say, my own personal thing has been respond, don't react. And then I think Christine mentioned as well journaling. I'm not a journaling guy at all, never have been. But on the recommendation of this book, I started doing it weekly. I go to Yellow Bernard, not now. I sit down and have a coffee and I use a thing called the Gibbs Reflective Cycle. And I'll put that in the notes. And it helps me to review my... my week. How's my week been? And it helps me to get better at responding, not reacting. So that's one of the things that I've done with this whole idea of emotional intelligence. But there's many different options that they give you in the book, such as they give you tools for doing it, like a family tree, where you can actually try and work out, you know, this is a very reader way of responding, or this is a very Hansard way of responding. This is a very jolly way of doing things, you know. And so you can actually begin to sort of go, I see why I do this, you know, and can begin to work against it. Now, I think Christine's probably going to text me soon and say I've got 5 minutes left. I'm not going to get through all of them. I'm not going to get through all my material. There are two more principles left. The second last is family.
I'd like to hear all of it. Anyone else like to go a little bit longer? Sorry, Christine.
Yeah. I've got nowhere to go.
Same.
Happy to look. I'll keep going and keep talking, and you can keep talking to me. But anybody who wants to leave at 1 o'clock, just you know, absolutely fine for you to go, and I totally understand. You know, you need your food. Don't get hangry. We know it would be sinful. Family and marriage. Okay, so this is their principle here. Now, I need to give you a quote from the book because there's a devastating quote. from the book. You just need to bear with me while I bring up the book. They have two chapters, like I say, on marriage and family. Now have a listen to this quote. It's from a pastor who participated during one of the summits, one of the group discussions. He shared this story. He said, "A few years ago, I asked my wife what it felt like to be married to me. After 20 years of marriage and 18 years of ministry together, I was very optimistic of her positive response. She said, 'I can't answer you right now. Give me time to think about it.' A few weeks later, I approached her again, and again I was optimistic of a positive response. 'Have you thought about what it feels like to be married to me?' She replied, 'Yes, I know I would never divorce you, and I would certainly never kill you. However, I can't help but think the boys and I would be better off if you were not alive.'" That's devastating, isn't it? And we were sharing this with a couple who we know, and we were sharing it as like, you know, yikes, whoa, you know, like a real sort of blowout. And this couple looked at us and they basically said, yeah, we pretty much feel the same as that. So that's not an American pastor in a study. That was a married couple who Miranda and I were sitting down to chat with who work in ministry. So this is a real thing. You know, I can't divorce you because God doesn't want me to, and I can't kill you. But if you were dead, you know, life would go on. Now, how does somebody get to that situation? How does a marriage get to that situation? Well, I can totally get it. I can totally see it. At the moment, Crossroads Church is streaming online our Sunday service. And so I've been going into the church building to stream. I go with one or two others, three or four others. Miranda stays home with the children. She has the church stream up on the television. The children are really not liking it because they love going to church, which is awesome. They don't like watching it on TV, so they're not singing, they're not participating. Miranda's trying to find ways to get them involved. By the end of the service, she's just had enough and is just feeling completely over it. Now, she doesn't just have to do that one week. If this situation continues, that's just what she has to do every week now. And so you can begin to see how difficulty, resentment, conflicting priorities, unmet expectation, all these things can begin to form within a marriage. So what they do is they go through in their chapter on family and marriage, what are the pressure points on a marriage? And don't worry, I want to talk about singleness in a sec, but what are the pressures on marriage that ministry does? Well, firstly, they talk about the normal pressures of just being married anyway. And they have a whole section of just being a human who is married is hard. Then they go through the nature of what ministry is and how that affects a family. And they talk about things like how many women actually feel like Sunday is what they call church widow day. That's the day where I'm the what's called the church widow. They talk about conflicting loyalties of church and home, that the pastor or the AFES campus director may actually, in a sense, be putting the ministry ahead of the home. They talk about abandonment because the leader is always on the job. And then interestingly, they talk about unmet expectations of the spouse as a confidant. They talk about this really interesting dynamic that most spouses went into the ministry with their husband or with their wife as a partnership. And what they found is as years went on, the minister would bring home less and less and less of the news and the information. The minister just wants to quarantine his home. He wants to self-isolate from church at home. Whereas the spouse, they're waiting and they're wanting to help, to debrief, to support, and they're not getting any of that. Because and so unmet expectations that the spouse has as a confidant, she or he was expecting to be much more involved than they are. Miranda and I have had a quick chat about this, and it's been interesting how we've managed over the years. And I have definitely done a lot of those things, you know. I have really been, there's times where I've been really quarantined off the home. And so from early married through to where we are now, we just had our 20th anniversary, it's changed a lot. And I've actually had to learn to share and bring a lot more home so that Miranda can be involved in it and she can actually support me. And I mean, she's brilliant at it, so why wouldn't I? And we've gone through very different seasons as well of reading the Bible and praying together, from when we had very young children, you know, maybe Alan, your situation, we hardly ever read the Bible when we were in your situation, right? Yeah. Through to now, we sit down and read the Bible and pray at least a couple of times a week, because we can just say to the kids, no, you're all out in the lounge room, don't interrupt us, and they can look after themselves. When the kids were little, yeah, you can get them into bed quick, but we were just knackered and we just needed to watch television and just stare. So that's a really interesting way in which the dynamic has changed over the years for us. Sorry, I am rambling a little bit now. I did say I just wanted to mention about singleness. I had a heart to mention singleness. Singleness has a lot of stresses too. I don't pretend to be an expert or understand them all, but and I know in these previous Vision 100 training days, Carl has spoken to us about singleness, but the single person, from what Carl said, needs to be much more proactive in organising their own birthday, asking for help when they're feeling down, asking for help when they're sick, you know, finding people to give them the physical touch if that's the sort of person they are. The family unit just has so much more of that. The bills, the cooking, the hanging out, the mucking, like it all just happens because everyone's there and together. And so singleness would actually bring a whole heap of stresses into ministry as well. I did email yesterday, Carl, looking for some good books on it, and you said nothing came to mind, but something possibly like Sam Albury, or I can't remember who else you recommended, mate. Sorry.
Vaughan Roberts, maybe?
Vaughan Roberts. Yeah. Possibly something there. Definitely an issue that we want to deal with. Any comments from you about marriage and ministry? I'm really happy for comments or things that you think I may have wrong that you'd like to tweak a little.
It's just really nice food for thought. And especially appreciate you kind of giving us examples of you and Miranda. I just wanted to appreciate it rather.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, mate. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm with Alan. Yeah, it's been awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Did you want me to do the last one or should I just wrap it up?
Well, I'd like you to do the last one, but I don't have anything else to do.
Please, please feel free to go off and get your lunch. It looks like Luke's cooking. Are you cooking something there, Luke? Is that it? Are you eating a cauliflower?
No, it's kind of a spaghetti pancake sort of thing. It's Jamie Oliver, so it's legit.
Okay. All right. Oh, I'm glad about that. Okay.
Something that rang true for me on the marriage and debriefing is I heard someone once say that if you are in a habit of debriefing with your partner, often you debrief when you need to because there's a problem. But when it gets sorted, you don't need to debrief about that because it's sorted. And so you go through this, you know, crisis resolution experience with church life, whereas your partner is just in crisis and so is left kind of feeling complicated and maybe resentful or defensive about things that got solved ages ago, but you didn't need to, you had no need to, you know, kind of debrief on the resolution. And so, you know, that was a good wake up call.
Yeah. Hey, Benny, Benny, you've been married way longer than all of us, mate. Have you got any wisdom on this? Like, just anything quickly?
Oh, no, I'm loving what you're saying. It's very, this book sounds amazing. I've just emailed my four blokes I meet with to pray to say, hey, let's read this thing over the next year. With debriefing in marriage, I was surprised by that unmet expectations of the spouse, but maybe because I'm a really verbal person. Emma tends to be more the time you choose to share with me is really irritating, like 20 minutes before we go to sleep. So,
yeah, nice one. All right, let's keep going and do the last one so then we can have a break. I've been surprised by these, in some way surprised by these principles. You know, for me, when I picked up this book, Resilient Ministry, I thought, number one, the big thing you need to focus on is solid preaching or something. And they do address that in an appendix. They say, well, hang on, where does preaching fit in? But through their study, these are the things that they've worked out that pastors need to focus on to have a resilient ministry. And the final one is leadership and management. Really interesting chapter. Leadership and management. Leadership is the poetry, soft skill, of gathering others to seek and oversee adaptive and constructive change. So they see leadership as a soft skill, adaptive, constructive change, gathering others together with you. Management is the plumbing rather than the poetry. It provides order and consistency to organisations. So they want to break up leadership and management. One is the poetry, one is the plumbing. And within this, they have an extended discussion on the difference between formal power and relational power. And just as an aside, they have written a book, the three authors, Bob, Tasha, I'm not quite sure who she is, and then John Guthrie, he's a sort of a theology lecturer. They've written a book on this type of thing, on the what they call the politics of church. So there's leadership and management. And the big thing is that pastors must embrace this aspect of church life. So imagine what we've been going through over the last few weeks. AFES have been having to sort of work out what are we going to do and our fundraising and which things are we going to run and online. Vision 100, Jess has been scrambling to put all this together. Crossroads has been going online. Your churches have been going online. Imagine if the last few weeks were the norm. You know, lack of structure, constant change, organisation in flux, it would be exhausting. And so good leadership and good management is a key part of my well-being and going the distance, but it's also how we care for the church by giving the church a steady ship, and even and especially the vulnerable and the needy in our church. Are really blessed by this because it means that power and personality isn't the way that decisions are made. And so leadership and management Firstly, pastors must embrace this aspect of church life, of leadership and management. And then the second thing that they bring out is something that I loved. The goal of leadership and management is to move people towards Jesus. I am Jesus. I am the hero. Jesus is the hero. And so I'm actually moving people toward him. The goal of my leadership and management is to move towards him. Now, they say this because many leaders feel like they need to be the one making every announcement. They need to be the one up the front all the time. They need to be effective. They need to prove that they're in charge. Don't worry, everyone. I've got this. I'm here. But actually, they're saying, no, the goal of the leader is to actually point people to Jesus Christ. And so leaders can actually be most effective rather than being the guy up the front, the woman up the front. The leader can be most effective by just bringing the right people together in the room and just pointing them in the right direction, bringing them, the right people together and pointing in the right direction. Do you have any, I'm going to wrap it up now. Do you have any questions about leadership and management? I cut that one a bit short, apologies.
No questions, Dan, but just the observation that, I think one of the things that struck me in the last couple of years is just how important those things are, particularly as our church has grown and how much time I've had to invest in getting better at that, you know, just because if you can't do it, it's just hugely problematic.
Yeah. And Carl, could you tell us some of the things that you've done to invest in that and to skill up?
Yeah, I've got a lot of reflection on it in the first place, and reading some books. I've been working through Wisdom in Leadership with my staff team. I read some helpful management books, The 1 Minute Manager and The Monkey. I don't know, some others.
So helpful, isn't it, to say this is part of looking after ourselves as well, to go like, actually, you know, just like going, exercising and eating well is too hard. I'm not that kind of person. In the end, it's good for you. In the same way, going, admin and management, that I'm not that kind of person, actually is not good for you. It adds a lot of extra stress into your life that long term is not good for you, even if you don't particularly like those things.
You don't care for others well. Like, actually, you don't care for others well if you don't do it either.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, in the appendix, they have a really interesting appendix. I reckon, Alan Reeder, if you're still there, you'd love this. What they do is they actually do a follow-up with all the participants and they find out why they didn't follow these 5 principles. So did you follow them? No? Okay, why? And they find out what stopped ministers who actually were the very ones giving this information, what stopped them from following? What were the reasons why they didn't? I was just thinking of you, Alan, just because it's like a comprehensive sort of way of kind of
wrapping it. Yes.
There were, for each of these 5 principles, they have one of the key setbacks or the key blockers for why pastors, ministry leaders won't go ahead and follow. So if you get the book, check it out. Check out that appendix thing or conclusion at the back. The other thing is that they really encourage you to do what Benny Farlett said. They encourage you to get this book, to read it yourself, and then to give it to your elders or to give it to your boss if you're an apprentice, or to give it to your, and definitely to give it to your spouse, so that he or she, so that they can read it. They really encourage you to actually share this book around. I noticed a question from Benny came up, you know, how do you get your leaders on board with this? Well, that's one of the ways. They actually say, share this book with your people, because the more your people are reading this, the more, like, the healthier your team will be. I'm just going to close with the final reflection, which is it's a really, really noble thing to finish the race well. It's a joyful thing to finish the race well, to still be there and to not have sinned, to not have failed, to not have disqualified yourself, to not have, fallen in a big, bad heap. It's useful and good for for our Lord. You know, what does Timothy call it? You're an instrument for noble purposes. So it's a good thing. Do things like this that will lengthen and strengthen your time in ministry, whatever ministry you're in and whatever ministry you move in. Lengthen and strengthen your ministry. I'm going to pray. Dear Lord, we ask, please, for each of us here that we might be indeed noble instruments, instruments that you use for your good purposes in your house. We ask, Lord, that we might be able to look back at the end of our lives and say, I have run the race, I have finished the job, and now there is in store for me a crown of glory which will never be taken away. To be able to say those words with a clear conscience will be a wonderful thing. And so we pray that each of us will get there and that you will receive the glory from that. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So I'm not sure if Christine's still here. She has left in...
I just got my lunch delivered.
Right. You tell us what to do, Christine.
So meet back here. Do look after yourself. Stand up. Do a bit of exercise. Get some freshish air. Open a window. And we'll meet back here at 1:50 for Ben's portion.